Good afternoon. This is Mary Louise Kelly. Colleagues at the Administration for Children and Families Office of Family Assistance, I would like to welcome you to this webinar on domestic violence and economic security offered through the Welfare Peer Technical Assistance Network. In my program, the Family Violence Prevention and Services Program, we support domestic violence services through 2,700 different programs across the country and serve over 1.2 million survivors and their children. But we know that many victims of domestic violence will not go to a domestic violence program for services. They may walk into a doctor's office, a TANF office, a child care center, and still need help. In fact, it's more likely than not that a woman who seeks TANF benefits has experienced domestic violence during her lifetime. And that's why we think it's so important that everyone who is working with women, working in human services programs, understands how to respond and recognize domestic violence when they see it, to respond appropriately in a supportive way, and to help people link to the services and supports and assistance they may need. So I think it's wonderful that you're going to hear today about the links between economic security and increasing options for safety for domestic violence victims and their children. And you're going to hear some great examples of how programs can enhance economic security and safety for these survivors in some very practical ways. Now, for an introduction to the rest of the webinar, I'm going to turn this over to my colleague Lisa Washington Thomas, the branch chief for TANF Technical Assistance. Lisa?
Thank you, Mary Louise. Hi. Our TANF regulations, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, gives states the flexibility to implement special programs that are primarily for screening of domestic violence and the referral of victims to the appropriate services. Many states who have chosen the family violence option also have the flexibility to waive some program requirements, such as work requirements and time limits as appropriate. Our office, the Office of Family Assistance, is focused on self-sufficiency and increasing healthy and stable families. We have also been alerted that domestic violence is increasing during these difficult economic times. And since we're not a domestic violence expert, we felt that it was extremely important to reach out to our colleagues at the Family Violence Prevention and Services Program in the Family Youth Services Bureau to provide useful information regarding family violence. In addition, this information has been favorably received at several of our regional events sponsored by TANF Regional Program Managers. We are excited to work with our colleagues Mary Louise Kelly and Shondell Dawson and our esteemed speakers Ann Menard, Eileen Stoll, and Kim Tico. Our presenters will provide a brief history of domestic violence, including providing comparison statistics of the prevalence of DV in the TANF population versus the general population. Then they will discuss how asset building strategies can help these victims. Our webinar has four learning objectives. The first one is to give TANF agencies and their stakeholders an overview of the relationship between economic security and the empowerment of survivors and domestic violence, to provide an outline of successful asset building models geared towards survivors of domestic violence, to raise awareness of how programs and partnerships are empowering survivors of domestic violence and are providing resources that lead to economic self-sufficiency, and to encourage collaboration between TANF agencies, the domestic violence community, and asset building programs. We have a packed agenda. We expect the conference, the webinar, to last an hour and a half with presentations again from Eileen Stoll and Tim Pentico, with Ann Menard moderating the webinar. We will only be taking questions and answers through the online web chat. You can go to the question and answer sections at the top of the toolbar and submit your questions. We're hoping to answer all questions, but we're expecting a large audience this afternoon. So if your questions are not answered, we will be providing a Q&A that will be on the PureTA website, along with a transcript and a recording of today's webinar. Now I'd like to turn it over to Ann Lenard.
Thanks, Lisa, and thanks, Mary Louise, for that welcome. And thank you all for joining us. It looks like we have a really nice mix of participants in terms of the roles that you play in your communities and in your agencies, as well as your location across the country. So that is really gratifying for us that so many of you were interested in hearing more about domestic violence, and we're expecting to get a lot of great questions. So I encourage you to post those as we're talking, and there'll be someone that's organizing those for the Q&A. Let me introduce myself and my co-presenters. Again, I'm Ann Lenard. I'm the Executive Director of the National Resource for Domestic Violence. I've worked on policy, practice, and research issues affecting domestic sexual violence survivors since the mid-1970s. I have been at the National Resource Center since 1994, except for a brief stint at HHS with the Family Violence Prevention and Services Program. I was a co-contributor to a report, Not Enough, What TANF Offers Family Violence Victims, which we released in March of 2010 with Legal Momentum, and which reported on findings of a national survey of staff from nearly 600 domestic violence programs and other agencies, including TANF, legal aid, anti-poverty programs, and child support offices, who are working with victims on TANF-related issues. And I'm happy to answer questions about that if people are interested. It's also my real pleasure to introduce my two co-presenters, Eileen Stoll, who's been active in the movement to end violence against women since 1992. Eileen, who holds a master's degree in public health, has worked as an advocate in shelters and community-based programs across the country. She currently coordinates the Economic Justice Project and prevention work at the Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Her current work focuses on helping systems and institutions improve their responses and strengthen the economic safety net for survivors. And I know the Washington State Coalition has really built very strong collaborations with a variety of state agencies in Washington State, as well as other collaborative partners. And we'll be pulling on that experience during this webinar. Also want to welcome and introduce you to Kim Pentico, who has been working with and on behalf of survivors of sexual and domestic violence since 1990. She has also worked at local domestic violence programs in Kansas and for 7 years at the Kansas Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. She currently works as an economic justice specialist for the Allstate Foundation Domestic Violence Program, which works to ensure and enhance survivor access to economic justice and safety, and that is a project of the National Network to End Domestic Violence, one of our collaborative partners. So I need to be advancing slides, so let me make sure that I can do that. There we go. So there you have the names of the folks who I just introduced. So what are we going to cover today? I know Lisa reviewed the objectives, but basically, we've organized the information into these four categories. I'm going to do some initial defining of terms so that everyone knows how we're using the term, for example, domestic violence. I'm then going to turn it over to Eileen Stoll, who's going to talk to us about domestic violence, what's money got to do with it, and make some connections or look at that intersection between TANF and domestic violence and some of the things that that are important to understand about when domestic violence arises within the TANF context. We're then going to pivot to Kim Pentico, who's going to talk about what we've learned from our work related to building economic security for domestic violence survivors over the last 10 years or so. It has really become a much more significant focus of domestic violence advocates. And there's a lot of strategies and lessons learned, and Kim is one of the best people in the country to talk to us about that, because she really has that both broad and very specific view. So we're going to get started. And I want to start by when we say domestic violence, what do we mean? And what you see on the slide in front of you is what I think is a pretty common working definition around the country. When domestic violence advocates use the term domestic violence, we're generally talking about, we generally understand that to mean a pattern of abuse and coercive behaviors that includes physical, sexual, psychological abuse, as well as economic coercion, and that's one of the focuses of today's discussion, used within an intimate partner relationship. Domestic violence typically involves the use of a combination of tactics aimed at establishing control over an intimate partner. So there's a couple things that are important about this definition. I want to raise them up a little bit. The first is that we're generally talking about a pattern. We're not typically talking about one incident of violence or abuse. So we're not talking about fights that get out of control. We're really talking about a set of interactions that really has at its center an attempt to control another partner. The other thing that I want to lift up is that we're generally talking about a range of tactics, so not just physical violence, although often physical violence within a relationship establishes that initial control over the partner and may be used to maintain control as the relationship continues. But we're also talking about these other tactics that you see here. The other thing that's important to understand about domestic violence is that it's not just physical violence. And in fact, if we're looking only for black eyes or bruises, we're going to miss a lot of domestic violence because it also involves all of the things that you see here and more, stalking and threats to kidnap, kill, or otherwise harm family, friends, or property. We've heard a lot from domestic violence victims who've said, you know, one of the most powerful, controlling things my partner did is remind me that he knew where my mother lived. And if you know that you have a partner who's willing to use violence and is trying to keep you in a relationship that you might want to leave, that's a very powerful threat. Threats to commit suicide as a tactic to keep someone in a relationship that they might be trying to leave, we also can see as part of this pattern. Use of degrading or coercive language. And, of course, controlling food or sleep or access to money, credit cards, or medical abuse. This last one, denying contact with family or friends, is particularly important. Isolating your partner, cutting them off basically from those who could provide information or assistance. And again, that's why it's so important, as Mary Louise said, that we have partners that an abusive partner may let someone go to the doctor or may not, may let someone go to the TANF office, and that may be the only place where they are going to be able to get information that there's help available or access services. And economic abuse is an increasingly recognized tactic, and we'll be talking about that quite a bit today. So what do we know about domestic violence? And we are very excited about a recent study just released, actually last month, by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the National Intimate Partner and Sexual Violence Survey, or NISVIS, which provided us much more rich and current information about the experiences of both men and women of intimate partner sexual violence, intimate partner violence, sexual violence, and stalking. And I just am pulling out two of the findings. One in four women have been victims of severe physical violence by an intimate partner in their lifetimes. The percentages for men are much lower, one in seven. But a particularly important finding is that women are disproportionately affected by sexual violence, intimate partner violence, and stalking. So while both men and women experience violence, women to a greater level, the impact of that violence is disproportionately impacting women. Women are left more fearful. Women are injured. They require medical attention. They are concerned for their safety at significantly higher rates than men. And these are both the survey based on reports from men and women. So as men and women describe their experiences, they are significantly different. Women are also twice as likely to miss school or work as a result of the violence that they experience by their partner. And I want to make note of the link that's in the at the bottom of the slide, and I encourage you to go go and get a copy of the NIFSA study. There's also a fact sheet. There's lots of information there for those of you that are interested in this this very new data. And it's because of the NIFSIS data and, again, other lots of experiences that and this disproportional impact of domestic violence on women abused by their male partners, and because they are most likely to be the victims that you will encounter in TANF and child support and other programs that you might be situated at, that we are going to be using gendered language today. But we also, referring to victims primarily as females, but we also want to, in doing that, we want to acknowledge that domestic violence also occurs in same-sex relationships, and men can be abused by their female partners. And all victims of domestic violence deserve our support and protection. We also know, as this slide, although the number is missing, and that's, I don't know how that happened, that in, every day in the United States, an average of 3 women are killed by a current or former intimate partner. So not by a stranger, not on the street as a drive-by, whatever. They are killed by someone with whom they were in an intimate relationship and may, in fact, have children together. So this is a serious issue in this country, and really one that requires all of us to do what we can to identify domestic violence when it occurs, to offer support and referrals to services, and to do what we can to address safety issues and increase real options for victims and survivors. So we're very happy that you've joined us in this conversation, and I'm going to turn it over now to Eileen, who's going to expand our understanding of the connection between domestic violence and economics. Eileen.
Great. Thanks, Anne. And I just want to say thanks to everybody. I'm really honored to be asked to be the person to talk about this. I know that there are many, many folks across the country doing incredible work, so I just really appreciate highlighting the work that we're doing at the Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence as well in Washington State, which I'm excited to highlight the great partnerships we have. I also just want to acknowledge that a lot of my thinking and doing have been really impacted by my predecessor, Tira Lindquist, and by my current co-collaborator, Tracy Underwood. So just want to acknowledge that. So let's move on to what's money got to do with it. One of the things that I feel like in the domestic violence field we've been really good at for the last 30, 40 years has been saying to everybody that anybody can be a victim of domestic violence. I think that we shouted that from the rooftops. We told folks, it doesn't matter the color of your skin, your class, your gender, your life experience, anybody can be a victim. And that is still certainly true. But what we also know is that women in poverty, and particularly women of color who are living in poverty, are at greater risk. And I just think that we need to acknowledge that and explore the reasons for that. So let me spend a little bit of time doing that. So we know that money has a lot to do with domestic violence. There's been numerous studies that have shown this, and I'm just going to break down what the research tells us. We know that it's a cycle and that things are working together as these gears show. And we know that having limited financial resources is a big risk factor for domestic violence. We also know that an abuser's actions during the course of a relationship can plunge a survivor into poverty, even if they were not in poverty before, and that leaving an abusive relationship can actually leave a survivor in an impossible financial situation. All of these things work together. You may come in at a different place in the gears, but we know that all of these are what makes domestic violence so problematic for folks living in poverty. Let's break it down a little bit more. So we know that when you have limited financial resources, the reason why this impacts your safety and your ability to actually have options for safety is that when you have fewer financial resources, you actually have fewer good choices. A lot of times people talk about how, well, I wish that they had made better choices. Well, oftentimes the choices that are available aren't that great. And when you're living in poverty and you don't have access to resources, even including a credit card to go stay the night somewhere when you know things are amping up, or that you can pull your kids out of school, out of daycare, and do a different one, if you don't have financial resources, you just can't have those options. So an abuser is able to gain much more control, and that research shows that the abuse is actually likely to last longer and be more injurious. I want to make sure that I say, though, that this does not mean that those living in poverty are more violent. Certainly, we know that that is not the case. And we also know that it doesn't mean that those with plenty of financial resources are not at risk. And in fact, we've seen that many times survivors are plunged into poverty because of the abuse that they've experienced. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. We also know that leaving an abusive relationship can make a survivor really have an impossible financial situation to deal with. We know that not only is that the case, but leaving is always one of the most dangerous times for a survivor. We know that from our work in Washington State, from our own fatality review, that over half of women who are murdered by their intimate partners are murdered after separation, so after they've already left the relationship, which, you know, is what we typically tell folks when they come and tell us that they're a victim. Often that's the first thing we say is, you've got to leave. And acknowledging that leaving is often the most dangerous time is really important to figuring out how folks can make decisions about their relationship that are the safest for them and their kids. For a survivor who wasn't living in poverty, leaving often plunges her into poverty because she won't actually have access to her previous financial resources. So for somebody who had a joint checking account or who was relying on their partner's income, that may then become closed off as a result of ending the relationship and leaving. For folks who have health insurance, oftentimes we don't think about this, but maybe they are on their partner's health insurance, that can abruptly be ended, or children can be taken off. And so that can be, you know, leave somebody in financial ruin if they have a kid with special needs, or just anybody. I mean, I was just joking with my presenters that I was home the last 3 days with my sick child, and I have the flexibility to do that. But when you're leaving a, you know, abusive relationship, you don't actually have as much flexibility, or maybe you're in a low-wage job where they don't include sick time. So we see how there's lots of opportunities for abusers to exploit that. And then finally, we also know that abusers' actions during the course of a relationship can plunge a survivor into poverty. Abusers use economics and finances as a way to control their partners. They do this because it works, and it's fairly easy to do. The tactics that abusers use often set survivors up for financial ruin if they ever try to become independent. We know from survivors telling us that oftentimes abusers will use their Social Security number and use their credit for things that maybe aren't the safest or best investments. And so that when a survivor leaves and they're trying to get an apartment on their own, they find out that their credit has actually been destroyed when they can't rent a place. Abusers also know that having financial freedom allows people to make different choices about their relationship. And so they might work to try and limit their opportunities to keep or get a job. And so some tactics might include harassing the victim at work, showing up, calling incessantly. And we know that of abused women, over 3/4 of them who had a job were harassed by their partner. As I mentioned, identity theft or ruining credit. A lot of times we also hear from survivors that the abuser has taken out lines of credit in their children's names, and so they don't actually find that out till much later. Not allowing a victim to work and develop a job history and skills. Also heard from survivors who were living fairly upper-class or middle-class lives where they were actually working for their partner. When their relationship ended, they had no work history because he couldn't be a reference for them or refuse to answer any of those questions. Not allowing somebody to have access to their bank account, forcing victims to hand over paychecks. One of the things that we just recently also saw in our fatality review here in Washington State was that many of the women who were murdered by their partners actually were the only ones in having the job in their relationship, and that their partners were really demanding them to give over their money, and they didn't have control over the income that they earned, and that if they didn't continue to work, that they would actually be homeless because their partner wasn't bringing in anything. And that was a really powerful tool of control. And then doing things to get the victim evicted. I'm sure many of you have heard these stories before, of folks punching holes in the wall or, you know, destroying the property, or, you know, once if they're not allowed on the premises, still showing up and harassing the neighbors. So we know that, as Anne mentioned and other folks have already talked about, we know that a large proportion of the population in this country experience domestic violence, which in and of itself is really unsettling and upsetting, and certainly we're working to try and end that. But we also know that studies show that between 50% and 80% of women receiving welfare have been victims of domestic violence. And that makes sense after what we've just talked about with all the reasons how your financial stability is really impacted by your relationship. And so it would make sense that folks that are trying to access TANF are coming out of those relationships or are still in and trying to rebuild. So we know that a quarter of women in the general population experience TV in their lifetime, and that the prevalence for the TANF population is much higher. You know, some would say twice or three times as high. We also know that for the tribal TANF folks that are on the call, that we also know that in the native population, you know, abuses are staggeringly high. And so that's a really important thing to you know, keep in mind when we're talking with all of our TANF programs. The other thing I'll just say about this before we move on is that we also know that the vast majority of TANF recipients are women. And so I think anytime you have a predominantly female clientele, you also just need to make sure that you pay attention to domestic violence. And in terms of the folks that are from child support that are calling in, we know that in some ways the domestic violence statistics and the who the custodial parent often mirror each other, and that from what I've heard, at least in Washington State, is that oftentimes it's about 85% to 90% of the custodial parents are women in Washington State, and the other percentage are men, and that actually mirrors who's perpetrating and experiencing domestic violence in our state. So I'm actually going to turn this over to Kim, because she does a really nice job of talking about why this might be and what folks in poverty experience and what anybody experiences when they leave relationships. So, Kim, I'm going to turn this part over to you.
Sure. Thanks. And thank you. I want to thank everybody for taking the time out of your busy lives to be with us today. So one of the things we talk about, and Eileen's done a fantastic job of setting the stage for this, but to take just a minute to take it out of those folks or the women we're working with or the survivors that we come in contact with and think about in your own life, what would be the options in our even in our own personal lives if violence occurred, and to take just a minute of what that would look like. And for many of us, our first instinct would be to call law enforcement. Or to leave, or to fight back, or to divorce and or separate, following all of those other things. And the reality is that none of those have really for sure positive outcomes, even for any one of us. Calling law enforcement, just think about what would that be like for you in your own home, calling law enforcement. Obviously, to get safe, if that's the immediate thing you need to do, you would do it. But it also means that if you have children in the home, explaining what has occurred, it would mean having law enforcement outside of your house in the middle of the night or in the middle of the day and explaining it to family or to friends what's going on, to have those conversations, to have your partner, potentially a co-breadwinner or primary breadwinner, or the person who takes care of the children, arrested and potentially jailed for a period of time. What does leaving really look like? Where would you go? If violence occurred, excuse me, would I be safer at a hotel or at a friend's house or at a family member's house? What would leaving truly look like for me or for you if violence occurred in your home this evening? What would fighting back look like? Would that be safe for you to do? Would that be your instinct, or would to flee be the instinct? Or if ultimately the response or the choice you had was to divorce or separate, how would that look for you and your family? Would that be financially feasible? Would it be religiously a possibility? For many folks, divorce is simply not going to be an option because of their faith or their community or finances for any one of us. So for anybody, the choices are not good when it comes to what your response or available resources are if violence were to occur in your home at any time. So then if we think about what those options would look like, particularly for leaving, I may lose my job if I leave. I may lose employment or job, particularly if the partner, my abusive partner, and I work together, or if he knows where I live and is harassing me in my workplace. I very likely will lose my housing. I can tell you if I were to leave right now, my partner, I would not likely be able to afford another place on my own remotely similar to what I have together. I travel a lot for my current job, and it would be very difficult for me to navigate my current employment if I didn't have a partner who was safe that I could rely on to help to co-parent with me. That would be a huge challenge. I can tell you that if violence were occurring in my home right now, leaving would be a really tough choice for me. As crazy as that sounds, that may not be a safe choice for me. It may or may not, depends. I would lose my health care if I were to leave at this point. My partner carries our health insurance for me and my children, and so that would not be a good choice for me. And obviously I would lose my partner's income. So for any one of us, again, leaving may not be a great choice, and still as a society, as a community, we often think that's the simple answer. And we know that that really, for many of us, is not. On top of the fact that we also know that leaving actually increases our risk of injury and violence for many survivors, that we see 7 times the increase of injury and dangerous situations when women and survivors make an attempt of independence, such as leaving. So these are just not good choices. Then if we think about then women living in poverty, it is even more of a bad choice to look at. What does it look like if I'm a woman living in poverty and I call law enforcement? I have actually almost an equal chance of going to jail as my batter does. There's a good chance we may both go to jail. There's just not always a great response. We're certainly working on that and being proactive in that area, but those are not always good choices, particularly for folks living in poverty. Leaving may simply not be an option. Where am I going to go if I have no access to a credit card to stay at a hotel or transportation to go stay with friends or family? Fighting back may clearly put me in danger of also being arrested, and divorce and separation may not just physically be an option or financially be an option for me if I'm living in poverty. So I hope that that helps us to sort of think through what that can look like for any one of us, let alone the really terrible choices that leaves women living in poverty. And that the reality is for those folks is that it means doubling up. It means going to shelter that often has a 30 or 60-day time limit. And can you imagine you picking up your family and your kiddos and going to a shelter and having 30 or 60 days to sort of get it all figured out and have another place to go to. And that access to these resources increase safety. If we can help folks get access to some of these resources, we know that her ability to get safe and stay safe is significantly increased. So that's where we as helpers and as social service providers and people who really just care about what happens to folks really can step up our game in making this possible for folks to get and receive safety.
Thank you, Kim. So this is where the good news is, right? That TANF actually can work as a safety net for these folks and in general. And I know that, you know, from my perspective, TANF is obviously not a perfect program, but it actually does have flexibility. And so we're going to talk about how that can work when it takes EV survivors into account and has policies, practices, and philosophies that really work to support and help create safety and at least promote economic security and empowerment for folks that are on its roll. So one of the ways that the TANF program has really embraced this is through the family violence option. And this was an amendment back in 97 that was attached through our Washington State Senator, Patty Murray, and the late Senator Paul Wellstone. And really, I just think this is an incredible piece of legislation that allows states, if they adopt the family violence option, to do some pretty creative and intentional things, if they choose. That said, I will say that Washington State, I think, does have one of the best adoptions of and implementations of the family violence option. So I encourage those of you who are not in Washington State to really to try and figure out ways to incorporate some of the great things that we've done here. And there are other states that actually are doing some great things as well. But there is that possibility. I think most states at this point have adopted the family violence option, but whether or not they've implemented a shift in philosophy and in practices, I think really varies across the country. So I did just want to give a little shout out to Washington. So if a state adopts the family violence option, they have to do 3 things. And you can't just do a couple of them, you have to do all 3. And so one of the things that you must do is screen individuals receiving TANF for domestic violence while maintaining their confidentiality. So pretty clear cut. States have implemented this in wildly different ways. Currently in Washington State, we have 7 questions that you ask them to determine whether or not somebody is experiencing domestic violence or formerly was experiencing. Once you screen them and you find out if they are in fact a survivor, then you need to refer those folks to counseling and supportive services. I think this is where Washington State really has done an excellent job in the ways in which most of our welfare offices, which we call community service offices, CSOs, here, is that we have actually, they contract with domestic violence programs and have placed advocates in the welfare offices. And so there are actually DV advocates on site that TANF recipients can meet with and have ongoing relationships with to do that work that really is outside the scope of TANF, but that really does impact your ability to participate and actually have TANF be a helpful source of support for you. So that, I think, has been really an incredible service to survivors in Washington State, and then some other states have also done that. And then finally, I think here is the beauty in this legislation is that you can waive any program requirement. This is really quite broadly written, that you can waive any program requirement that makes it more difficult for individuals to escape domestic violence or that unfairly penalizes those who have or are being victimized or puts individuals at further risk. And so this really leaves it wide open that you can really waive any program requirement that you see impeding a survivor's ability to participate and ability to get or stay safe. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how that has looked. So this flexibility that the Family Violence Option provides really gives survivors the chance to recover from violence and the creativity to establish plans that work for them and move forward. It also enables support groups and other work on domestic violence issues to be counted as work activities. So that's specific to Washington State. The DRA, a number of years ago, the Deficit Reduction Act, actually undid a lot of those really helpful provisions, if you ask me. So, you know, this has varied across the country on whether or not this counts for federal participation guidelines, but certainly Washington State, at least, has adopted our own participation guidelines that we use. And then, of course, that doesn't necessarily get reflected in what we report to the feds, that, you know, they have a little bit different standards. And we meet those as well. But it's nice that it gives that flexibility. So how it has worked in Washington State, I just want to give a few examples, and then I'll turn it back over to Kim to talk more about the kind of the broad economic justice work across the country. But in Washington State, and I should say that really nationwide, the Family Violence Option does give the opportunity to waive any of these things, and this is just what we've chosen to do here. But the legislation actually does call out child support and time limits specifically. So in Washington State, if you are on TANF, just like everywhere else, you are required to participate with child support, and by virtue of the Family Violence Option, you can waive that requirement. And so here in Washington, you're able to get what we call good cause for non-cooperation with the Division of Child Support, which means that you can either not participate at all and not cooperate with giving child support any information about the father of your children or the other parent of your children, if that would put you in greater risk or put your children in risk. And this really is critical for survivors of domestic violence. We've heard from many, many folks that it's the child support that really triggers a re-engagement or a re-enaction of abuse. And so what we hear is that what happens is, you know, maybe you've left and there's a little bit of calm period. Well, when the child support notice is sent to the abuser, that really reignites their desire for control, because they figure, well, if I'm going to be paying for these kids, I want to have some control over what they do, which, you know, makes sense if it's not an abusive relationship, right? But it can be really problematic if that control is coercive, manipulating, and scary, right? So that waiving that program requirement, I think, is hugely beneficial and very important to the safety of survivors and their kids. We have two levels of good cause here in the state, and one enables somebody to continue to get the child support, but they don't have to necessarily cooperate and their information is protected, and the other one just stops collection altogether. We also can waive job search requirements in the state, and so this enables survivors who are on TANF but who just aren't quite ready to go to job search, or maybe they can go to job search, but actually doing that would put them at greater risk because the place where they do that is actually the same place where their partner or ex-partner is going, or it's a small community, and that's just not a safe thing for them to do. So there's ways to waive that requirement and have them still be working on things that will enable them to be economically self-sufficient later on, but doesn't necessarily include that very specific job search component. And then finally, time limits. Here in Washington, we for many, many years had a fairly open interpretation of the time limits, and that that has been cracked down recently, and we really stick to the five-year time limit. But we do waive that for folks that are actively engaged in domestic violence activities and who are working with an advocate. And again, that's why the advocates in the offices are really, really beneficial, because it provides that resource not only for the survivors but also for the workers at the TANF office, so that they actually have support around how to help the folks in their caseload. So I'm going to turn it over to Kim, but I think we'll talk more later about some of the things that in the current economic climate that are more difficult to achieve with the family violence option, but that I think there's still really good reason to do, and I think just a lot of opportunities to continue to do great practices across the country. So that's all I have for now. Kim.
Thanks, Eileen. And I will just mention, Eileen has much fancier screens than I do, so I'll just put that out there. So I'm going to talk a little bit about asset building in particular, and in relation to what we're doing, particularly through the Allstate Foundation, our partnership with the Allstate Foundation. So let me just talk a little bit about asset building, and then I'll go into some of the things we've been able to do through our program and some things that we've seen being out there training advocates in their communities. So in doing this and thinking about asset building, I think one of our greatest challenges in general is that it feels like information that's beyond us, particularly when I'm out there training advocates. When I say things like building assets, they assume that that is something that even they can't or don't do, so their ability to learn about it to help others with feels really limited. So if we think more about really what building assets mean, and the definition of assets is that it's a useful or valuable quality, person or thing, something that creates an advantage or resource. Or another definition is that an asset is a resource controlled by the entity as a result of past events and from which future economic benefits are expected to flow to the entity. So an asset really can also just be information and education about things like finances, financial education, money management, budgeting, credit, and things like that. So really, information becomes, for many of us, including survivors, that becomes their ability to not only get safe, but to stay safe. We really talk about economic justice is sort of beyond the immediate safety, beyond immediate shelter, but really allows survivors to become secure, which is really what we're focusing on. So I kind of would encourage us to always think about renaming that term asset or having conversations about what asset building means. I sort of always joke around that we need to rename it, getting our mojo back, but really relying on us and relying on our ability to learn more about financial management so that we can carry that on to others and provide that to others. So here's a little about what we're doing. We at the National Network to End Domestic Violence have been so fortunate to partner with the Allstate Foundation, and have been doing so now for 7 years. And in doing so, we're allowed to address economic justice and financial empowerment issues for survivors of domestic violence. And we've done that through grant making, financial education, and technical assistance and training. And what we're probably most proud of, in particular, was the grant making. Fantastic, because it allows us to feel like Santa once or twice a year. But it's been creating the financial education piece of that. And we created a specific curriculum really geared towards the needs of survivors of domestic violence. And what really is unique about that piece is that one entire module, there's five total, one entire module really is looking at how to do financial planning and safety planning through the lens of finding more information about assets and money and things like that, understanding that the needs of these folks is very different than the general population. So how to do that really safely. And we will provide more information about how to see that online. If anybody's interested, you can download the entire curriculum online for free. So just a little bit about the grant making is we have a Moving Ahead Through Financial Empowerment grant program. It is now a $1 million annual grant program. State domestic violence coalitions are eligible for this, to apply for this. We currently have 15 state domestic violence grantees, and they're all working on financial literacy. They also are working on microenterprise and microloans, job skills, and also creating IDA or match savings accounts. So I just want to highlight two of the programs that you might find interesting that I think they've been able to do some really neat things, one of which is the Vermont Network, and they have a program called EZE, and it stands for Education and Support for Economic Empowerment. They work specifically with Vermont Works for Women Partnership in helping survivors of domestic violence gain job skills. But they're also partnering with a local credit union, and they're able to do a 2-to-1 match for savings accounts for survivors, meaning that every dollar that a survivor saves, it is matched with $2, one of which is through a community partner, and the second dollar comes from the Allstate grant program. And they've also been doing a microloan program. Another program's doing that too, but they're doing micro-repair, microloan program. And how this works is that they're allowing survivors to get very small microloans and pay off debt, which has helped them repair their credit. They're allowed to pay these small microloans back $10 a month. And then they're actually also doing a match debt program as well. It's a very small piece of this program, but this has paid off hugely for survivors. I'll talk more specifically about microloans here through the Kentucky Coalition. Kentucky Coalition really has been for a decade now and longer has been doing a traditional IDA match program with this through the federally funded match program. But they're also, they also have a financial education component to it. But what is new and sort of unique about this is that they're also able to do a non-traditional match savings, which means the federal IDA program is constricted to the three areas, and it has a cap at how much you can save, and it is a strict one-to-one match. And then what you can use it for is limited. The non-traditional match program, they use no federal dollars for it. They use all private dollars, some of which is Allstate money, and then other contributors. But it allows them to do a much higher ratio, but to then also, they're also able to use it for non-traditional things that are beyond the federal IDA program. So if somebody needs to save money to buy a washing machine, they can use the match savings program. Or if they want to save it to buy an automobile, and that's probably their biggest program, is the car match program. And we know that that has a saving for a car, having access to a car, particularly in rural areas, is huge and has a direct impact on many folks' ability to gain employment, to go to school, but to really gain financial independence. For many communities, is relying on having their own automobile. I actually live in Kansas and can tell you that we don't have great public transportation programs in many of our communities. If you don't live in three different cities in a 105-county state, you don't have access to public transportation. So it is critical, and they have really met this need through doing this program. They also have a microloan program, and this is where this Kentucky starting this has grown into many other programs doing this. What they've done is they do a small $100 microloan. It really sort of doesn't matter what they spend the $100 on, although many of them are using it to pay off a debt of some sort or to catch up on some past due bill. And then they pay it back. It is a non-interest loan. They pay it back $10 at a time every month for 10 months. But the unique piece of that, and what has really turned into a fantastic credit repair program, is that the Kentucky Coalition then reports every month to the three credit bureaus. They are paying their loan on time as promised. And we are seeing, on average, these survivors who participate, on average, are increasing their credit score by 50 points, which is huge. And some have been in the hundreds. This is life-changing for many folks. I can tell you, when I did direct services many moons ago, we didn't talk about things like credit. The importance of somebody's credit score right now has more importance than ever before and has really impacted their ability to really function within our very financially focused world right now. So credit repair is huge. And this is, I think, doing economic justice in general through our movement is one of the few times we've been ahead of the curve. So I'm really proud of it, and I think that these programs sort of really highlight that. I've talked about what this financial education piece has been and what we've done with this for at the National Network on Domestic Violence, that it is a specific curriculum geared towards the needs of domestic violence survivors. We cover safety planning, budgeting, credit, how credit works, what are different kinds of loans. And then we also do long-term planning, which I think is fantastic. And one of the things I'm really proud of that we have really given that information to survivors. We don't just assume that they just need to know how to budget and that's it, that they don't deserve to know what an IRA is or long-term planning looks like. That they may not be ready to do anything about it, but at least the information is there and we can touch on some things so that when they are in a place in their life, that they have those tools available to them. So we do talk specifically about safety planning in the curriculum, but this is an important piece for anybody who's working with domestic violence survivors and talking about money and finances, is that you have to understand that what financial abuse is, and it's about controlling how money is spent. And Eileen gave great examples, overusing credit, forcing a person or not allowing a person to work and things like that. But we also then talk about particularly once, if somebody's still in the relationship, still doing financial safety planning, explore how to set money aside safely and talking through some really creative ways to help survivors who are still living with their abusive partner, how they can start creating some of that safety net. We talk about the pros and cons of disclosure. It may not always be safe for folks to disclose. There may even be laws that protect a person in employment and things like that if they're a victim of domestic violence. But if they don't think they're going to be treated fairly or the law is going to help them out in that particular situation, it may not be safe to disclose. So really talking through the pros and cons of what disclosure looks like, who to disclose to, and when and all that, and what their rights are. We talk about how to do a safe housing search, and that that if you go to a large apartment complex, that they may likely pull your credit report. And if your batterer has enough information and know-how to maybe poses you to pull your credit report as well, or has access in other ways to credit reports, that would show up then on a credit report. So really thinking in detail about how to stay safe when trying to get safe. So here's just briefly, and I'll get through this because I know we need to move on, but I do want to talk about what we've learned. And that this is, in my now 21-year career in doing this work, is some of the most satisfying work I've ever done because I see the impact that this is having not only for survivors, but the advocates that they work with. This is changing lives for lots of folks. That what we've learned is that none of us were born knowing this information, and that we're not always taught this information, and that for many of us, doing this work comes with baggage. One of the first exercises that we do when training the curriculum is to ask folks to think about what, growing up, what were you taught about money? What were you taught about what you should know about money? Did your family talk about money? And that we get a broad range of responses. You don't talk about it. That money doesn't grow on trees. If you can't afford it, you don't buy it, don't use credit, don't worry about tomorrow, spend for today. So all of us come with these messages about money that we were taught at a really young age. And particularly if you were taught not to talk about money, and now I'm asking you to sort of throw it all out there and tell me everything that's going on with you financially, there's going to be some challenges. And we have to sort of honor that, and we have to deconstruct that, spend some time doing that, that we can't just jump in on the first meeting and say, so let's talk about a budget, and not expect to be some triggers there for folks and to be aware of that. And we've learned that we have to go slow. Like I said, we can't talk about budgeting on the first day. For many folks, even just saying the word budget makes people break out in hives. And that we've learned that we also have to take time with the folks that are doing the work. Many of our advocates, amazing advocates, are living paycheck to paycheck. This may come as a surprise, but we're not terribly well paid as a movement. And so many of them are having their own financial struggles. So really going slow and allowing advocates to learn about this and get excited about it and not be scared of the topic and issue has been one of the unintended consequences, but also has been a great gift for us to give those doing the work. And then again, talking about money is hard. It is really hard and has many, many triggers, particularly for survivors of domestic violence, where money and finances were used against them. And then if we want to sit down and talk about money, and I don't take the time to think or ask about these things, and, you know, the whole time she's thinking, I was always told I was too stupid to handle money, and then I want to sit down and talk about budgeting, that may be a huge trigger for her. So taking it slow and not making assumptions about people and their knowledge and where they're at. This slide here provides you some information about how to get a copy of the curriculum online. There's a couple of different ways to do it. You can go to our website or you can go to the Allstate Foundation website. I encourage anybody that's interested to take a look at it. We're pretty proud of it, and we'd love to hear some feedback. So I think that I've talked plenty, so thank you all.
Hi, thanks, Kim, and thanks, Eileen. This is Ann Menard again. We wanted to also, in addition to the resources that Kim just provided you links for, and it's my understanding that you will all have access to these PowerPoint slides, so you can pick up the links there. We also wanted to let you know about some special online collections that the National Resource Center on Domestic Violence has pulled together on our online resource center, which is bonnet.org. These are both special collections. They happen to be highlighted now in the featured information, so you can pretty find them easily in that top box. But there's one on asset building and individual development accounts, which gathers together all sorts of information, including research, tools, briefing papers, training supports if those are available. In this case, on asset building and IDAs. We also have one that we just put up on earned income tax credits and other tax credits and how they can be particularly helpful to domestic violence survivors and others who are involved in asset building. So we direct you to those for some additional information as well as all the other information that's on VAWNet. I think at this point, I want to give a colleague of, oh, I guess you're going to, oh, here they are, okay. A colleague of Mary Louise Kelly, Shondell Dawson, at the Family Violence Prevention and Services Program at ACF, to talk a little bit about the network of resource centers that FIPSA funds. Shondell?
Yes, thank you, Ann, and good afternoon, everyone. As Ann mentioned and as Mary Louise mentioned earlier, the Family Violence Prevention and Services Program not only supports domestic violence shelters, local programs, state coalitions, and the domestic violence hotline, but we also support a network of resource centers that provide a tremendous amount of training and technical assistance on various intersecting issues related to domestic violence. Next slide, please.
Do that.
Thank you. The state domestic violence coalitions that we support are critical partners and can be very helpful to grantees across the country that are trying to help serve and improve responses to victims of domestic violence. We have the Washington State Domestic Violence Coalition featured today. We have many coalitions that are a part of the network of economic justice programming being supported by Allstate and the National Network to End Domestic Violence. But they serve as statewide leaders in their efforts. They're very connected to the local programs within their communities. They can help think outside the box around policy and responses and also look at specific programming and problem solve any very serious or challenging situations that agencies may be encountering. The contact information for the domestic violence coalitions can be found on the NNDV website under the coalition tab, and there are state domestic violence coalitions for each state and U.S. territory. And we encourage you all to seriously think about ways to partner with state domestic violence coalitions and local programs if you all are not doing so already. Next slide, please. In addition to the state domestic violence coalitions that we fund, we also fund 9 special issue, culturally specific, and national resource centers that focus on various different issues related to domestic violence. The National Resource Center on Domestic Violence is one of our grantees and provides a tremendous amount of research and information on VAWNet on their online resource center, as well as helping to support several special collaborations and initiatives such as asset building, earned income tax credit, working with the Office of Child Support Enforcement, as well as working with OFA grantees. The other national resource center that we have is the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center, and they provide training and technical assistance to the tribes and tribal programs that are funded by the FIPSA office, as well as working in collaboration with the other resource centers to look at how we can improve our responses to tribal and Native women who are experiencing domestic violence, sexual violence, and also help improve practices both within tribal communities and non-tribal communities and being more supportive and responsive to survivors and their families. We have four special issue resource centers that focus on various issues. We have the National Health Resource Center on Domestic Violence, which is housed within Futures Without Violence. They provide technical assistance as it relates to medical and healthcare communities' responses to intimate partner violence, information and referral, and capacity building. They also have leadership nationally around the issue of home visitation and domestic violence and have released a curriculum around that for individuals to utilize and better responding in those communities that are housing home visitation programs. In addition to that, they have national leadership around engaging men and boys to prevent intimate partner violence, as well as looking at issues and innovative program related to teen dating violence. The Resource Center on Domestic Violence, Child Custody and Child Protection is housed by the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges. They provide a tremendous amount of research as advocacy and leadership as it relates to the intersections of domestic violence and child custody, as well as working within the child welfare community to improve responses to victims of domestic violence. And they provide training for advocates, attorneys, and judges, as well as looking at research and doing analysis and providing policy guidance on systemic change. The National Center on Domestic Violence, Trauma, and Mental Health provides a lot of research and advocacy strategies related to improving responses to the lifetime trauma that many victims of domestic violence and their children unfortunately experience, and also helping to improve trauma-informed care and trauma-informed strategies within the domestic violence program, as well as engaging with mental health professionals to think about their responses and support of victims of domestic violence in the context of their clinical and non-clinical settings. Next slide, please. The Battered Women's Justice Project houses the Criminal and Civil Justice Center, and they provide a tremendous amount of support to legal advocates as well as attorneys in looking at how the criminal and civil justice system is responding to victims of domestic violence and their children. They also have a special set of expertise and work relating to military families, and they've been doing some work with our colleagues in the Department of Defense Family Advocacy Program and looking at trauma and intimate partner violence and responding to military families and improving responses there. We have three culturally specific institutes that are supported by the FIPSA program: the Asian and Pacific Islander Institute on Domestic Violence in the African and the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community, as well as the National Latina Network, which is housed by Casa de Esperanza. And these three organizations provide national leadership on really moving the domestic violence field as well as other systems and improving the cultural relevancy and linguistically appropriate responses to victims of domestic violence, analyzing the very unique aspects that culture, race, and oppression have on victims of domestic violence and their families, as well as leading special initiatives relating to trauma, to teens, to community organizing when it comes to community engagement, whether it's within the Asian Pacific Islander community, the African American community, or working with African immigrants, and also looking at the Latina and Hispanic populations. And so the websites are there. There are a wealth of information, and we encourage you all, as you think more about the intersection issues of domestic violence being impacting the lives of the families accessing TANF, if you all need training and technical assistance, we encourage you all to utilize these websites and links to connect with our resource network. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Shondell. This is Ann Menard again. Before we go to questions, I have a few questions that I want to I want to pose to Eileen and Kim and have us have a conversation, and Shondell can join in as she wants to as well. And then I know there's been a couple of questions that have come in, so we want to get to those as well. But before we do that, Eileen and Kim, you know, we know from all our work as domestic violence advocates working with a wide range of systems that building and sustaining meaningful collaborations can be really challenging. Can you talk about what you see as some of the challenges facing domestic violence advocates, TANF agencies, and economic empowerment agencies like some of the ones on the call today who are trying to work more collaboratively? And then I'm going to ask you to tell us what you see as some of the successes.
Sure. This is Eileen. You know, I think that I'd say the biggest thing that's impacting, I think, most social services right now, and I just really see impacting our state, is the whole idea of trying to do more with less.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what we're seeing is that each agency and each specific, you know, human service is really being tightened. And what we find is that in our state, domestic violence programs are really being squeezed, and in fact their funding is really being limited. At the same time, other community programs and other state institutions are also being squeezed, and so they're looking to domestic violence programs to take up the slack. And I think that has been a really tough balance for us to work within, because certainly I think domestic violence advocates are essential to the work of the TANF program, and I think they're really, you know, people don't get into this work, whether it's TANF or domestic violence, because you know, they just, for the money, let's be honest, right? They get into it because they really genuinely want to help people. And I think that has been a really big challenge for us when we truly want to help and we see that our services are so impactful and are so helpful and, in fact, can be life-saving and really life-enriching, that to then expect us to do more is really problematic. So I see that one of the things that I think the TANF program has is some flexibility and really trying to figure out how to maintain funding or at least protect the funding, and how to make sure that we're using the creative opportunities that we have with things like the family violence option to use our partners in a way that works for them and really works for the survivors on the caseload. So I think that's a big challenge that I imagine is happening across the country.
And Kim, when you think about the, you know, the collaborative partnerships that have emerged from the Allstate grants, either directly or, you know, just kind of happenstance, what do you see as some of the challenges that people have had to overcome or that organizations have had to overcome?
I think, I mean, it touched on a piece of it for sure was, I think in general the economy's really been hard. And I think that's the current excuse as to why we're not able to do this right now. I think it's always been hard. But this is because of the economy and the current economic climate, that's where a lot of folks are coming down on saying that, you know, there's just not enough money to do this work, even though we know that the investment is worth it. We know the investment pays off. So I think that's a challenge. I think doing economic justice in general is not an easy sell. It's not, you know, saying let's talk to law enforcement, let's train the courts, let's that kind of stuff is easier because it's the place we go to when violence occurs, right? That's the immediate response, and that is important. That is critical. But it's not hard to explain why that's important. It is harder to make this economic justice sell in doing crisis work. This feels like an add-on. This feels like when we've got the time and the money and the energy, this is the work that we could do. That's a nice thing, but we can't. And yet those of us doing the work know that we will in the long run do less crisis work if we can get this figured out. So I think that that's part of the challenge as well. And I think if we're bringing in more private partners, because it's not, quote-unquote, for lack of a better term, it's not a sexy sell doing economic justice work, it's harder to get private folks involved as well. It's sort of amazing that people like the Allstate Foundation continues to fund this work is because it's not a clear business reason to do this work, but they continue to do it. And there's other ones out there. So I think those are some of the challenges that we've seen. And I think some of the things we touched on earlier was our own ignorance as a movement, but I think as a society and community as well, around what is economic justice, how does this work, that's one of the challenges as well.
Okay. And I'm going to ask one more question, and then we'll go to the Q&A period. But so if you had to pick out one exciting success that you've seen, and that could be nationally or within your state, including, of course, expanded economic stability for survivors, but also the kind of the mutual benefits of the partners involved. What would it be? You know, when you think about the successful collaborations that you talk about, what is it that's most exciting about them?
For me, it's been just demystifying and sort of letting the air out of advocates' anxiety around this issue. That when the advocates are going to their mailbox every day and are dreading opening up a mailbox because there's bills in it that they can't figure out how to pay or why things are the way they are, and they don't themselves budget and things like that, that getting advocates excited about their own financial future and really taking some ownership of that and not feeling bad about wanting to think that some point they may retire, that's been, for me, one of the most exciting things, because when the advocates get excited about it, they do such a better job of then translating that to the survivors, and they come at it with a whole different lens and approach, and that's when we see programs take off. I think that's probably one of my most exciting pieces about doing this work.
How about you, Eileen?
For me, it's hard to separate out all of them, because I think they sort of all go together. But I think one of the things that I've seen is that we actually experienced some cuts in our state with the advocates that were based in the CSOs, which is really upsetting, and I'm still hopeful that that can be undone. But the outcry that I heard from the workers, that they really, the TANF workers themselves, really saw those advocates as being not only a support to the survivors, but a support to them, really showed me how impactful those advocates in the CSOs have been to really create more of a, holistic safety net that I think a lot of people hope for when they think of the TANF program. And so in some ways, out of that really unfortunate occurrence, and one that, again, I really do believe can be mitigated and hopefully undone, I really did see the impact. The other thing I'll say is that something that hasn't necessarily continued, but that when it was happening just brought me so much satisfaction, was that one of the things for a number of years that we were able to waive job search instead of was when advocates were actually doing that financial education at the CSO. Those groups have not necessarily continued, and I think it's really unfortunate that that has not happened, because what we were finding was that survivors that were attending those groups were really kind of getting a whole new sense of worth, and that they could actually do this on their own once they were off of TANF, or even when they were transitioning. One of the things that we really learned from those groups was that, budgeting, the people that do it best are the people on TANF. That's actually not the group of folks that we need to talk about budgeting with, because they know how to do it. And so I think that was a real big learning moment for all of us, that they really, have a lot to share, and that, it kind of goes with that notion of groups that, everybody wants to give and to get. And so that was one of those instances where folks that were on TANF really have all this great skill of how to actually function and get by in poverty. And so I really hope that we're able to expand that work again. And when that was happening, it was, I think, a really exciting move.
Thanks, Eileen. Lisa, I'm going to call on you to let us know what questions came in through the chat. And while you're organizing that, I know that there was one question about how to access the National Intimate Partner and Sexual Violence Survey from CDC. And I'm just going to tell you what that website address is again. And it will be on the slides if you get a hold of that. It is www.cdc, for Centers for Disease Control, .gov/ violence prevention, /, NISVS, NISVS. And again, I encourage you to go and look at the findings that are presented there. So Lisa, did you have any, I know there's some questions, but I haven't been able to kind of track them.
Sure. Thanks, Anne, Eileen, and Kim. The first question we have is, how can we educate the judges more on domestic violence relationships, and what is the best for the children?
That is a great question. This is Ann. And I'm really glad that Shondell was able to go through the resource centers. I'm scrolling back. One of the resource centers, the Resource Center on Domestic Violence, Child Protection, and Custody, is housed at the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges, and they, along with the Battered Women's Justice Project, the Resource Center on Domestic Violence, Child Protection, and Custody is the second bullet there. So you can see there, it's NCJ, FCJ, you can see their website there, as well as the Battered Women's Justice Project, which is www.bwjp.org. It has a lot of resources available for training judges. Judges, including bench cards, curriculum, they themselves offer judicial training across the country. The state coalition, depending on where the person's located, also may have resources related to judicial training that may or may not be a priority of the state domestic violence coalition. But they would surely know where those resources are available. So there's a lot of great training materials available for judges working in different types of courts, working in domestic violence courts or working in juvenile courts and making custody decisions. So the resource network that is funded by the FIPS office is a resource for the person who asked that question.
And this is Eileen, if I could just weigh in too, in terms of the, I mean, that's a huge issue, which obviously we could do days and days of training on. But the thing that, in terms of tying it into the TANF program, the thing I will say about that is that, you know, obviously, that reflects an understanding that going through the family law process is really tough, and it's also really tough when you're on TANF. And so I do think that there is some flexibility, again, in that family violence option, that you can actually waive program requirements that are limiting somebody's ability to attend court hearings or actually provide, you know, the information to the court that they need in order to maintain or get custody. And so I do think that that's just something that's really important to take into account when you're making somebody's plan for participation, that going through those family law proceedings is a really difficult process and often takes a large toll, especially on folks who are being manipulated through that system by their abuser. So thanks for that question.
And I'll just pop in for a second, too, here. This is Kim. That one of the things that we talk about quite a bit is that there are also many opportunities within those that criminal justice system or particularly civil justice system to make allowances and to increase protections around finances and access to resources that we don't always take very good advantage of, because this is a place where we need to do some education in the court system in particular, that almost all protection orders do allow for some sort of financial relief. And when I go across the country and train advocates, I hear time and time again, our judges will never order temporary assistance, whether it be for spousal support or child support, in a protection order, that they don't think that that's the place for it. But for many survivors, that's their only opportunity potentially to ask for those things, particularly if they're not married or they're simply never going to be able to afford a divorce. That is very appropriate, and it's not about being greedy or whatever some thoughts are, but we really do know her ability to secure some temporary assistance from her partner may really have a huge impact on whether she's able to leave and leave for good. Many survivors return because they have no resources to be elsewhere, but if a judge were to order some assistance or payment of child support or even payment of rent or assistance in other ways, or continuing to pay something as what seems simple or not very important, but continue to pay things like insurance, car insurance, and health insurance, and they can order that in a temporary order and a permanent protection order, can have a huge impact on her ability to get and stay safe.
Thanks. Lisa, next
Thank
is
you.
Another
next question. We have a lot of questions about particular underserved populations. So we have another question about high school. Do you have any information about programs that are effective in high schools?
Well, this is Eileen. This is, again, a little bit off topic in terms of the TANF information, so I'm not exactly sure if I'm missing something, but I'll take this opportunity to promote the thing that we're currently working on at the Washington State Coalition, which is available certainly nationwide. We have an In Their Shoes curriculum, which is an experiential learning training that you do where you actually get cards and you become a teen character and you make choices and you see what happens in that relationship. And we actually are just about to release
one in the late spring that is for classroom use in high schools, so directly for teens, and it's just called In Their Shoes, Teens and Dating Violence Classroom Edition, and that should be out late spring, and certainly you're welcome to go on our website and see more information about it. You can just go to www.WS as in Sam, BA, D as in dog, B as in Victor, .org, whiskative.org, and there's more information. And we've learned a lot about from that. And then I know that Anne actually just released a whole bunch of Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month materials that I imagine are somewhere on your website, and if you wanted to direct people there.
Actually, what month are we in? February is Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month, so there's actually a lot of activity and information available now. I think my colleagues in the other room are doing a webinar on what role parents and caregivers can play in preventing Teen Dating Awareness Month, preventing teen dating violence. On Vonnet.org, www.vonnet.org, there is a link to a whole series of resources related to Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month, including highlights of curriculum that are being used in high schools or in other settings, how to use social media, which is, of course, the way that young people communicate with each other increasingly. So there's a lot of good resources. It also identifies partner organizations. There's a number of our partner organizations that really focus on teen dating violence awareness and building healthy relationships or encouraging teens to develop healthy relationships and have the skills to sustain them. So this is a good time for you to ask that question. There's lots of resources available. But I would go to Vonnet.org, and in the top box, just keep scrolling through until you see the Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month link, and that'll take you to lots of resources that we've developed or, again, our partner organizations have developed.
Thank you. We're running short on time, so I have time for one more question, and that was, what are the unique issues you have encountered when working with Latino clients on these issues?
This is Shondell Dawson, and I'll jump in. Our resource center, Casa de Esperanza, has been doing a tremendous amount of work around economic advocacy, intimate partner violence, and immigration. And the issues that range in providing services to domestic violence survivors that are immigrants range from having access to bank accounts and resources, as well as having limited English proficiency and having challenges accessing resources not only within their own language, but having someone to talk to about safety planning, but then also having inherent fears if they are undocumented about reaching out for support, in addition to encountering challenges with attempting to access jobs and employment and various different types of level of limited access to what's available in their communities, and then also being able to talk to someone within their own language about what they may or may not know about how those systems work. Additional information about working within the Latina community can be found on the Casa de Esperanza website, which is listed in the link, the series of links that are at the end of the PowerPoint slide. You can also call and contact them in terms of asking questions around training and technical assistance and resources. They have a huge network across the country that they support with community-based service providers that are working with Latina populations across the country.
Thank you, Shondell.
Mm-hmm. And Lisa, I want you to, if you could let people, well, I can let people know that we weren't able to get to a lot of the questions, but we're happy to answer those. I think we're happy for Lisa to forward those to us if there's email addresses attached to them, and we can respond individually. So we'll try to get answers to all your questions.
Thank you. And we will also be posting a list of the questions and answers when we post the transcript. And so we will send you those questions so we can work even after this webinar.
Great, thanks.
I want to take this time to thank Anne, Eileen, and Kim for your wonderful presentations, as well as our partners Mary Louise and Shondell from FISBE. And I also want to thank our peer TA staff, Camille, Patricia, Lou, Leslie, and Sarah. We're going to take a few minutes right now to just to take a temperature check of how we're doing, as well as and see how useful the webinar was. So our first polling question is, do you feel it is important for TANF agencies and domestic violence programs to partner? And I'll give you a few minutes. One is strongly disagree, two, disagree, three, neutral, four. So five is strongly agree. Okay, next question. I feel it is important for survivors of domestic violence to have access to asset building programs. Again, one is strongly disagree, and five is strongly agree. Okay. Next question. The presenters had valuable information to share. One, strongly disagree. Five, strongly agree. Thank you. Next question. I have a better understanding of the resources available to TANF agencies and its stakeholders to help create partnerships and train staff on domestic violence. Okay, next question. I have a better understanding of a relationship between economic security and the empowerment of survivors of domestic violence. Again, five is strongly agree, one is strongly disagree, with others in between. Okay. Next question. I learned about successful asset building models geared towards survivors of domestic violence. Next question. I learned about strategies that I can use for creating partnerships between TANF agencies, the domestic violence community, and asset building programs. Okay. Next question. Are webinars an effective tool in providing technical assistance? Okay. Next question. This is the last question. The logistics of the webinar ran smoothly. Thank you very much. We are always interested in trying to help our participants and to have a better life, to have a healthier life, to have a more stable life. It's more important for us to try to do good work, to do good so that people have a means to raise their children both and move them into self-sufficiency and move them into a healthy, safe environment. We are always eager. One of the old TANF administrators used to say, TANF is not good enough for anyone, and we want to make sure that we are providing services that will help our TANF recipients to have a life that we would be proud of and that we would want. So I thank our presenters, and I thank all of you who came out, who tuned in to listen to us, ways to improve the lives of our constituencies out there. Thank you so much, and have a good afternoon.